Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Black Hole Cinema. I'm Dan Taylor, back after a few weeks away, and I'm being joined by the man himself, Mr. Tony Black.
Good evening all.
And also returning after a while away is Matt Latham.
Hello there.
When was the last time you were on, Matt?
When was the restraining order?
That was back when the Oscars was on, wasn't it?
I think that was momentarily forgotten when you were on the Avengers special
about
2 months ago.
I was live from a prison cell.
Yeah, that's right. How's things going? Have you been released? You're released now, I assume.
I do, yes. I'm pretty sure. You know how rappers have like platinum discs littering all through corridors?
Yeah.
I have that with restraining orders from celebrities.
Oh, wonderful. It's quite a long list, I'm thinking.
It's a long corridor.
It's a long corridor. The grin on his face as he said that was quite unnerving, I must say.
You're in the cell with him?
Yes, I am. I'm in his house arrest.
Yeah,
cell, with
visiting.
His tag.
You should see the bling on my ankle brace.
As Emma mentioned a couple of weeks ago, we've changed format slightly. Tony, who hosted last week, did his segment. What did you talk about, Tony?
I talked about Steven Spielberg. It's a new section called Director's Corner, which will be back very soon when we do a Terminator special. But you can probably guess what I'm going to talk about there, but I won't spell it out.
McGee!
Yep. Obviously McGee, of course. McGee!
And Emma did, was it Dead Meat? Was that her?
Yeah, Emma did Dead Meat.
Which I'm sure will be back next week, I think.
Yes, it will be, if that's the plan. And Emma's talking about horror.
Yes, and my feature, which will be coming up later in the show, which is actors, but also later on, as we do more of these, it'll be directors and films who haven't won Oscars, who should have done. But this week we'll be concentrating on male actors who perhaps have been nominated or been part of a nominated film, but haven't necessarily won the Oscar themselves. But we've also got the news coming up, as well as the UK box office. And our reviews this week are of the film adaptation of Entourage, as well as the Ian McKellen doing Mr. Holmes later on in the show. But up first, we've got the news stories for this week. I'll kick off with the first one. It's Spider-Man related. And WikiLeaks have been at it again, leaking emails between Sony and Marvel, where apparently, I believe it's Marvel, has said that Spider-Man not only needs to be white, but he also needs to be straight. So that's a controversial news story to start off with. Matt, you mentioned that they are thinking of doing a TV series.
I read something, it was on my Facebook feed, I think, earlier today, that they was thinking of doing an Amazing Spider-Man series, but with Miles Morales rather than Peter Parker. So I'm not sure where. Well, I think it's the more. Isn't it the movie series that was talking about the casting rather than.
Yes, yeah, it was actually leaked. It's actually emails from back in September 2011. So you've got to assume they're talking about the Amazing Spider-Man rather than the supposed deal that's happened most recently, where Marvel obviously are getting more of a say about the cinematic Spider-Man. But basically, they've said. Peter Parker character traits include his full name is Peter Benjamin Parker, he is Caucasian and heterosexual, and then goes on to say a lot of other stuff. Is that too specific, or is, you know, are people being too, you know, sensitive to the issue, or, you know, are kind of Marvel / Sony in the wrong?
It's basically a long character document that they're given.
Yeah, I think if Marvel have just gone, this is what we're allowing you to do with the character, because it also says. The agreement includes that Spider-Man is not homosexual, in brackets, unless Marvel has portrayed that alter ego as a homosexual in the comics, which, as far as I'm aware, they haven't with Peter Parker.
I think what we're facing here is an element of practical box office concerns.
Yeah.
Now, you know, let's take away any discussion about the right and wrongs of this. Let's go with practicalities in terms of how these people think. These people aren't moralistic. They're not bothered about what people feel and think. They're not about being progressive. They're not about necessarily. They're only progressive if it benefits their money. Now, these people know that there's a lot of people, unfortunately, in America, a big audience share, who not want to go and see a gay Spider-Man.
Yeah,
they won't.
Very true.
Like they won't want to go and see a black Spider-Man. So the reason they're saying this isn't because they're being racist or necessarily or trying to offend. They unfortunately are playing to the gallery, and it means that until people decide to take a stand against this kind of thing and risk losing a lot of money, mm-hmm. nothing's going to change, and you won't yep. get people going to see this regardless. That's the ultimate truth of this, and it's a sad truth, and it's an unfortunate truth, but that's what it is.
But it's just the same as they also say in the document, Spider-Man does not use, or Peter Parker does not use foul language beyond PG-13, does not smoke tobacco, does not sell or distribute illegal drugs, does not abuse alcohol, does not have sex before the age of 16, does not have sex with anyone below the age of 16. So they do go into quite a lot of detail about the do's and don'ts with the character. It's obviously just variety in this case who have done the art and picked out these two things.
I'm thinking, is it cocaineonline.com saying, Marvel don't want Spider-Man dealing drugs. This is an outrage. We want our superheroes to deal drugs.
Yeah. I'd like to know how much you know about cocaineonline.com, because you seem very knowledgeable about that website.
Our next news story is actually again from Variety.com. I found quite a few stories from there this week. Inside Out debut exposes absurdity of box office horse race. And basically the article goes on to talk about how the horse race mentality that both studios and kind of the public and the media kind of look at actually ignores the fact that the film that perhaps gets second or third place actually is doing just as well, or does perhaps better, and is setting records in its own right, because it's the only place that I've seen that apparently Inside Out has actually set a new record for best ever opening for original film, crushing the 77 million watermark that was set by Avatar back in 2009, because they opened this weekend in the States with $91 million, which, you know, was only just 10 million shy of Jurassic World. But because Jurassic World and we you know, such a massive film, and we're always interested in who is top of the box office rather than who's second, nobody's actually talking about the fact that they're setting records in their own right. And it actually goes back to the fact that Mad Max, despite how much we loved Mad Max, it was second to Pitch Perfect 2.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. There's been a lot of hype about Inside Out, hasn't there?
Yeah, it's been touted as the next big Pixar. Pixar thing. It's getting a lot of really great buzz before release. We won't get it for another month, I think in July we get it.
It's got a great cast as well.
It's a great cast. It's a lovely idea. It's a typically Pixar animated idea. It could be the next up, you know, in terms of benchmark and emotion. And it's nice to see it doing well. But again, Pixar is one of these built-in brands now. That adults will go and see Pixar. This is the thing. You know, there's a lot of animation that kids would only traditionally go and see, and there's still animated films that kids would only traditionally go and see. But adults enjoy Pixar just as much as children now.
Yeah.
So they will go, and quite a lot of them will go and watch it in IMAX as well, and IMAX 3D. And that's an important point to make with these blockbusting opening weekends like we've just had with the ridiculous Jurassic World take. You know, a lot of this is now down to the IMAX factor and the fact they're charging people double.
Yeah. So, well, that's the thing, is obviously that's where a kids' film particularly will always kind of be behind, because you won't take a family generally to an IMAX. And actually, a lot of kids won't sit through 3D or IMAX, and, you know, so it's easier for them and cheaper for the family to go and see a 2D performance of something. The vice president and chief analyst of boxoffice.com said that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Being number one is overrated, because any other weekend, Inside Out would have been number one. But not only is it pitted against Jurassic World, it's also having to compete, as you said, with the kind of 3D and IMAX effect of that film. Whereas this one perhaps wouldn't take as much money in that area as maybe Jurassic World still, because we all remember Jurassic World is taking 110? It's about over 100 million Jurassic World's taken in its second week. That's its second week it's taken that amount of money. And 91 million is impressive, but obviously it's the first week for most states in America. It's the first week of the summer holidays. So that's likely to actually probably have a better run, in the fact that for the full 6 or 8 weeks of the summer holidays over in the States, Inside Out will be showing back-to-back, you know, all week, every day, and will do well. Yeah. Just the same as when it's released over in the UK. The reason we partly will wait a month is because our summer holidays is almost a month away from where the US holidays are.
Yeah,
so, and, you know, we've got well, I say we've got America, we've obviously got July 4th coming up, which is a massive day for family cinema, whereas something like Inside Out particularly will excel.
Yeah, but it's nice to see it doing well, you know. It's I think it's always important that these Pixar films do it, because
yeah, absolutely,
they're so well done, and they give out really good messages for children, so I'm all over that. I think that's fantastic.
Wonderful. And our first review of this week is Entourage.
Boy!
You're upset.
Upset? I gave you $100 million. You're $15 million over. You agreed to not go over.
Because you said I couldn't direct unless we agreed.
It's like when a girl asks if you want to bang her hot sister. Of course you say no. Neither of you really believes you mean it, though.
What is he doing here?
For trouble.
These girls out here are crazy.
Oh my God, no! We know each other!
Do you remember me?
Didn't she used to be really fat?
Movie star Vincent Chase, together with his boys Eric, Turtle and Johnny, are back. And back in business with super agent turned studio head Aria Gold on a risky project that will serve as Vince's directorial debut. Matt.
Question to you, Dan. Where did you get that synopsis from?
IMDb. Does it not sound anything like the film?
Because I've always had a bit of an iffy relationship with the TV series.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you some background for me. Because I owned a good five... I think I was about five seasons on DVD at one point. And I really did enjoy the series. It's not amazingly great. It was very funny, and it had quite a few interesting things to say about the nature of friendship and perhaps a little bit about Hollywood in general, but the show always had a bit of a problem when it came to conflict or trying to generate drama. No pun intended. One of the characters' name is Drama. just to offer some clarification on why that was a pun. That wasn't supposed to be a pun. But I think the show never really made things difficult for the main character of Vince until about the third or fourth series. This film ends up having a lot of those similar problems in terms of that it kind of forgets what conflict and drama and the natural story is. Mm-hmm. Because you say you gave me a synopsis and says that it's about Vincent Chase creating his directorial debut. 10 minutes in, the film's more or less finished. So the film's not going to be about him filming this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be about the troubles of a very well-known actor in the universe of Entourage and the troubles it will make doing this film. So I thought, okay then, so what's it going to be? Ari Gold, who's played by Jeremy Niven, who used to be his agent in the series and now the head of a studio, needs to get more money because Vince needs more money to edit the film. Okay, so it's going to be about financing, which technically it is, but then that story gets slightly pushed out the wayside, and you then it's an excuse for Hayley Joel Osment to show up and be absolutely shit, and in a very strange Texan accent, which I probably could do better.
No.
Go on, give it a go.
I always... No. You're not going to have the dignity of my Texan accent now because of that.
You don't have any dignity.
Of course not. But you think it's going to be up financing, and then it's kind of not. Then you think, oh, hang on, Hayley Joel Osment's character, who's a co-financier, he's blocking the film, blocking money for the film so Vince Chase can finish editing because he doesn't like the fact that his half brother's in it for four scenes. I want his half brother out there. So the film's really about the relationship with his half brother, because his half brother, who's played by Kevin Dillon, the character's called Drama, and he's the less famous brother of Vincent Chase, and he's played by Kevin Dillon, who's the less famous brother.
Matt Dillon.
Yeah, so meta humour. But no, that's get brushed outside as well. And then it kind of stumbles its way to a resolution, and you're thinking, okay, what exactly is the film about? And then it's over. And and you're thinking, okay, the characters got happy endings, but what was the actual story of the film? It doesn't seem to have any cohesive idea of what it wants to be. It throws in a subplot with Kevin Connolly's character of E, which is so mind-bogglingly dull and has no overall effect on the actual plot that you wonder why it's there. And the general consensus I got when I ended up watching it was it's more an extended TV episode or a finale for the TV series. Characters turn up and show up with no real introduction that if you'd never seen the show, you'd go, then why is Constance Zimmer there trading barbs with Jeremy Niven's character? Why is Debbie Mazar? Oh, I love Debbie Mazar. And her character is one of the best things in the show. She's not in every episode. She's like in only about a third of them, but she's one of the best things in the show. As Shauna, she's Vince Chase's publicist, and she's also the publicist for drama as well. And then she shows up and starts saying, "You need to do this, this, and this." And anyone just watching this is thinking, "Who the friggin' hell is this girl just coming up telling people what to do?" Alan Dale turns up in a suit, in an American accent, as he always seems to do.
Yeah.
Only on the big screen this time, rather than the small screen. And suddenly starts shouting stuff. And he only gets like one exposition line of dialogue of who he is, when in fact, if you'd watched the TV show, you know he's a very powerful man who's made things a bit trouble in the past. And it seems as if HBO would just wanted to stick this on the big screen rather than on the small screen.
It sounds like it's doing that really sort of that bad trick, for want of a better description, of doing a movie version of a TV show without paying any heed to people who may not have seen the show before.
Yeah, it does try and, because it has its info dump. I mean, we saw Veronica Mars.
So that's what I was about to say. I was about to say the fact that I was going to compare it to the Veronica Mars movie, which almost does everything you said. It doesn't do everything this film apparently does do.
Because it does. Veronica Mars' film does give some kind of resolution to the characters, but it was very accessible. There's like an opening primer that helped you a lot. It helped you a lot. Entourage does try that with an introduction, and it's like a celebrity showbiz interview type thing, which gives you like Vincent Chase grew up in this, and he's surrounded by his entourage, blah blah blah. But the only problem is it's hosted by fucking Piers Morgan, one of the first few people. Once you get this opener where you see this boat and all these girls in the bikinis come in, and then the three Vince's entourage joins him on his honeymoon, and he finds out that after 9 days, Vince's marriage at the end of the TV series has been annulled after 9 days, which is like, oh, right, okay.
So it meant nothing?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think he only sleeps with one girl in the 8th season, which is unheard of for Entourage. But, and then it suddenly cuts to Piers Morgan saying, "Who is Vincent Chase?" And I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake. What's this prick doing on? What's this prick doing, like, 1,000 times the size of me? Why is he on the big screen? And then he just seems to be on there for what seems like an absolute eternity. Unfortunately, he does show up again in it, and he tries to act, and he seems to try and read prescriptive lines, and
the thing is, it's an odd choice of person as well. Seeing the fact that I'm assuming this film must have been made before he got fired, because even then he's still not the most accessible for an American audience.
I mean, I was sitting there going, like, why can't someone like Ryan Seacrest? And at one point, I remember thinking, actually, is Ryan Seacrest a name I've just made up, or is he an actual person?
No.
And I remember saying,
it is a real person.
Yeah, so I thought I might have made him up at one point. It's not the worst thing. It's just,
of all the people they could have chosen, you know, James Corden, Conan O'Brien, you know, anybody that they could have chosen out of the talk show host, they chose the guy that got fired.
Yeah,
and that no one likes.
You see. Now I have a question there, because maybe I don't necessarily think this is true. I have no opinion of this at all. Right, I've never seen the TV show. I have never had any much interest in seeing the TV show. I don't have any prejudgment about this movie at all. But maybe one of the big I did listen to the Mark Kermode rant, and boy, was it a rant! You know,
I did see it afterwards. I didn't watch it before I went to go and see it.
He hasn't been that savage about anything. He was honest about this at the time. Yeah. Sex in the City 2, and that is his most epic rant ever. Now, one thing he said was that this film has no level of satire. It tries to make out it thinks it does, but it doesn't.
Yes. Yeah.
Does the inclusion of Piers Morgan, who we now know has been sacked, right, and he's, you know, he was effectively rejected in a way by the US, is that not maybe a hint that there actually is some satire in here, that maybe Piers Morgan being in it is actually the point, that he's an idiot?
Well, with the commode thing, and he probably says as well that he's never seen the series, and he's been told something about the series might be better. I've never seen the series as being satire. It's not a satire of Hollywood. It's more a show. The main thing about the show is the friendship between these four people, where one of them happens to be like a world famous movie star, and who's got a brother who was famous for doing like a 1995 sci-fi series, like a Hercules style series called Viking Quest, and like ends up going to conventions and stuff, and thinks he's the best actor ever, and his manager, etc., etc. It was never meant to feel like it was supposed to be satire. It's actually Mark Wahlberg was a massive creative executive producing force on the TV series, and quite a few of the storylines in there was based on events in Mark Wahlberg's life. So there's the argument that it was almost semi-biographical at a point, more than being satire. And there's the whole thing about him being the whole male fantasy bit, that he says, this is not a fantasy I want. There's probably people out there probably do want that fantasy. It's not particularly marketed very well in the show, in the film itself. It's very much like, the opening bit is like a rap video, where you're walking, within 10 seconds you see a girl walking across topless. And I did say to myself, I did kind of guess that you, Mark Mark would be ranting about that. I said, no, I'm not going to be mad. I'm not going to be bad. That's not going to annoy me. And it did annoy me 10 seconds in. it's very rare that I get annoyed about that. I'm like, yeah, okay, take it at face value. It's just going to be like this.
But he hates, and he's probably not the only one, he hates the very idea of the messages that this film is conveying by the sound of it. You know, and it's putting across this idea. I'm purely going by what the people are saying here, but it's putting across this idea that all this kind of vacuous chasing of celebrity and wealth and consumerism is cool, without any hint of the fact that in reality it's a dream that very few people ever get, and it destroys and wrecks most people's lives who get it.
Yeah.
So there's there's no underlevel of, well, yeah, okay, it may look good on the outside, but underneath it's a pit of horror and nest of vipers.
Was there any kind of evidence of that in the TV series? Was there any dark side to it? Or was it all just happy-go-lucky, let's get pissed and shag girls?
So the first few seasons, it was pretty much let's get pissed and let's shag girls. And the moment you try to introduce more conflict into it, it kind of decided to go a bit off the rails. And I only recently realised I never saw the 8th season, a bit of the 7th, and there was bits about Vinny Chase having a drug problem and going into rehab, which I completely missed, admittedly. But all those references to all that was just gone. Doug Ellis, who created the show, he wrote and directed it.
Yeah,
he seems to always has a problem with trying to generate conflict. There's probably a lot better stories that could have done in the film. I mean, the whole fact about someone like Vinny Chase trying to create this film that he wants to make would probably have been a good series. But then, as soon as he says he wants to direct, he jumps to 8 months later, and then he needs to go and get this money for financing and stuff. And it turns out that the only reason that Haley Joel Osment is actually denying Vince Chase the money is because of Emily Ratajkowski or something. Because I think Vince is now dating her, and like Haley Joel Osment is jealous. And that's it.
I've got to be honest, looking at this was not something that kind of appealed to me, because I hadn't seen the TV series, because the trailers made it look so naff, I had no real interest in it. But the kind of premise of the series is quite interesting. For me, I just kind of feel like that this isn't the kind of thing that translates onto film as a direct continuation of something that already exists.
It's not.
I think they could have done a reboot as a film, but I don't think they could do a continuation and I think Asimic 24 knows quite well, I think it knows the film won't work, which is why they try to do a continuation of the series instead.
Yeah, it's the film itself feels like an extended TV episode, which is a criticism I've seen quite a lot, and I've got to agree with.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, a movie doesn't have the same amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, and then I really wanted people to be misjudging this film, but the part of me that liked some of the characters in it, I mean, I love Ari Gold. Ari Gold's one of the, he's probably the best bit in this series, and he's the best bit in the film. Jeremy Piven spends it trying not to go on a massive rant that he used to do because he's in anger management, he's in his marriage, and he's not going to go on the rant, be the angry ranting, like using the largest amount of swear, the biggest amount of swear words in one sentence. He's going to be doing this, he's going to be doing this, and then he snaps, punches the glass out of the window, and he's back. And the part of me that loved that kind of light scene, that considering he's not the main character of the series, he gets the majority of the narrative push.
But the reason is because I've never seen the show, but if somebody said to me, name a character from Entourage, I would name Ari Gold. He's the person I think of.
Oh, he's definitely the greatest character.
He's obviously, throughout the series, he's the character that made the biggest impression.
Yeah.
It wasn't the other guy.
Yeah.
No.
Right? That's the point.
Yeah.
That's why in the film he's got more to do.
The thing that strikes me is that Doug Allen is kind of thinking one of two things. A, that, you know, he could have done a reboot of this and brought it to the big screen to a whole new audience, or he can continue this kind of, not, I'm not going to call it ego trip, but he can continue having this, you know, labour of love for this TV series that he wants to continue. But unlike Rob Thomas in Veronica Mars, he seems to think that this can be marketed to a whole new audience, because for some reason this has got a massive worldwide release, whereas Veronica Mars, we struggled to even get it here in the UK, and, you know, arguably that came through the fact that itself, you know, struggled to find funding to get the film off the ground and then distributed. But Veronica Mars and, you know, Rob Thomas at least had a kind of self-awareness that this was more a film just for the fans of the TV series, and if it picks up new fans, then great. Whereas from the impression I seem to have get of Entourage is that Doug Allen thinks it's going to pick up a whole new legion of fans, and they're going to get, you know, two or three fucking sequels out of it.
I can't see him making any sequels from it. There is some elements
of closure. Well, no, it's not done very well.
Well, yeah, there are elements of closure, and I'm kind of glad I went to see it because it does feel like they've closed it.
But the thing with that as well is, I mean, I think you're right, Dan, but I think the problems they've got there, realistically, is that Entourage has never been a massive, mega success everywhere. You know, it was a relatively successful show. That ran for a long time, but it wasn't necessarily we're not talking Game of Thrones, Lost-style mega hits here.
No.
That would absolutely chew up the box office if they'd become films, because they would have done. You know, we're talking about that. And also, you're talking about this. Yeah, okay, I know Mark Wahlberg's in it and you've got celebrity cameos, but we're talking about a show with no stars.
Exactly.
No major stars.
Yeah.
You know, and so you put all the, no major director either to anchor it to.
No.
You're talking about a show that's quite niche in a way.
And
you know, it may have this consumerist, this populist idea, and it'll be all about girls and cars and all this kind of thing, but it's quite honestly, it's a bit of a strange thing to have made a movie like this.
Yeah, I'm kind of shocked we're even talking about it, really.
Yeah,
you know, when you've got the comparison, really. Is Veronica Mars, the set was kind of really low budget and really limited release, worldwide, not just, you know, in America, UK, worldwide, it was a very limited release, and that had a massive film star in it. By saying massive film star, you know, Kirsten Bell has carved out quite a good...
Yeah, you know, Kirsten Bell is... Yeah. Most people
Exactly, you know, and so she's kind of, they didn't need to put Mark Wahlberg in it because it already had a recognised star. And again, you've got X-Files, again, you know, you've got two stars there that translate both film and television. But this has absolutely nobody, so they've had to kind of shoehorn Mark Wahlberg in. I don't know how much he actually gets in it, I'm assuming it's no more than an extended cameo.
It is pretty much an extended, of all the celebrity cameos in it, they actually do work like they did in the TV series, is that if you've got something set in Hollywood, you do cross paths with occasionally. There is a quite funny bit as Ari and his wife are going to couples therapy, and they walk out, and Kelsey Grammer's there going, it's a waste of money.
That's Kelsey Grammer. He sounds like an Arab. waste of money.
Yeah.
Can't be Kelsey Grammer, yeah. Really.
Yeah, no, so in conclusion, it just seems bizarre that this film has got the kind of worldwide release that it has. It's, you know, arguably the second biggest film of the week. And I know it's been released at a time where there is a massive blockbuster around, but it's just bizarre that this one in particular seems to be, you know, seems to be, we're talking about it. It's a bit odd that we're talking about this one and not something else. So moving on to the box office for last weekend now. But we'll all be surprised to know that 2x2 has not had a recurrence. It's not gone back into the top 10.
Oh, no.
No, and I'm disappointed. It's only number 14. I was hoping for the best. And Holmes actually slipped out as well, the top 10 this week. That's number 11. But no surprises is that this is kind of, it's going down like a lead balloon. Tomorrowland. It's only been out here in the UK for 4 weeks, but it's already at number 10. Number 9 is Avengers Age of Ultron, which, with the summer holidays, etc., cropping up in America and us in a few weeks, that might well still hang around in the top 10 for a couple more weeks yet.
That's dropped a bit. That was
it has. Number 5,
week.
Yeah.
Dropped
quite a bit. Number 8 is London Road. That's one of our only new releases out last week. It's a UK release. Took 216,000 in its first week. You actually went to see this for your birthday, Tony. Number 7, Empire Strikes Back. Cinema 2015, that's at number 7.
That's gone up a place.
Mm.
How much has it taken now?
The weekend gross was 261,000. That is the total to date, apparently, so far. Site average, 5,000. So that's quite impressive.
They're being cheeky here because they're counting the £75 entry fee as their stub, which is why this is going to this will be in the top 10 now till September.
Oh, actually no, I'm reading the wrong line. Sorry, it's actually the total gross today is 666,000. Oh, that's not a good one.
It took 300 grand last week, yeah, for 2 days. They're being very cheeky. This is going to last all summer, which I think is a real... I mean, I don't begrudge Star Wars anything, but it's a cut.
It is a bit, yeah.
It's a real cut.
Number 6, it's never been able to leapfrog Pitch Perfect. It's still one place behind, is Mad Max Fury Road. Still took just under 400,000 last weekend. But it's down 51% on the weekend before, but has taken over 16 million so far to date in the UK.
Still the best film of the year.
Pitch Perfect 2, number 5. Not the best film of the year, but no. arguably very enjoyable, nevertheless. Taken total gross of 600,800,000, so just coming up to the 17 million mark, I'd imagine, by the time it drops out of the top 10.
I just said 600 million.
Did I? I meant 60. 600 million would be mighty impressive.
For the British box office.
Yeah.
Man, you totally laid on that one.
Have you become a verb?
Yeah. Totally lathamed.
Lathamed. You've been lathamed. That'd be a new show for ITV.
Mm. Insidious Chapter 3 is number 4. That was reviewed a couple of weeks ago. Was it Chris Haig that reviewed that one?
No, Ian Austin went Kermode on its ass.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Not very good, apparently.
No, but Chris Haig liked it, didn't he, though? So,
he may have done, yeah.
Owen Hughes from Fart Critics, when he reviewed it, totally laid on that.
Oh, no, did he? What did he do?
He accidentally called it Incestuous 3.
No, he didn't. Did he really?
No.
One of the panelists kind of accidentally led him to say it.
But, wonderful.
Yeah, he totally laid on that as well.
That's a beautiful laid on though there.
So if you want to go and rib Owen for that on Twitter, he's at OwenHughes86. Good luck, Owen. Number 3.
Don't tell him who sent you.
Number 3 is The Rock's San Andreas, which took just under £1 million last weekend, which is into its third week now, taking just under 10 million to date. Number 2 is the fantastic comedy Spy, which I bloody loved. I thought it was brilliant.
Oh, good. I was going to ask you, actually, if you liked Spy. I thought it was great. I really enjoyed Spy.
yeah, 1.5 million last weekend. Don't know what it would have taken this weekend, but probably still roughly that £1 million mark.
Going.
But then obviously it's competing against the number one spot, which is Jurassic World, taken at 19 million last weekend in the UK. Believe it or not, though, not the highest grossing film of the year so far in terms of opening weekends.
Fast and Furious 7.
It's behind quite a few, believe it or not. Obviously, Fast and Furious, as mentioned, also behind Avengers Age of Ultron, which is the top spot. Also behind 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, God.
Horrendously enough. Also behind The Theory of Everything. So, there we go. That's interesting to know. It's about the fifth or sixth spot at the moment for the release here in the UK. But it's still taking monstrous amounts of money. Both here and in America. For us as a company, I work for a small company in the Southwest. It's been our by far our busiest film of the year so far. Obviously, we're generally outside of city centres and stuff. We're more in small towns and stuff. So it's a film that really has completely blown us away. And in America, it still retained the number one spot this weekend, taking, there we go, $102 million in its second week. Which
remarkable.
Is just
that really is remarkable.
Ridiculous. I know it's difficult to compare US and UK because we're like talking about like £1 million over here sometimes.
Yeah,
but that is an astronomical amount of money, and no doubt it will still take at least half that next weekend.
I think it's likely to be, if not the highest grossing film of the year, then we're in the top three now. I think really the steam it's going. I think.
We've had some big hitters though already this year.
Well, I was about to say this year we've already had two, nearly three if you count 50 Shades of Grey, which did very well,
and Fast and Furious.
Yeah, you've had Avengers, Fast and Furious, 50 Shades of Grey, and now this. But it's, you know, it's a combination, I think, of just these massive, like 50 Shades of Grey was this massive populist book adaptation. Fast and Furious 7 is riding the whole coattails of Paul Walker's death as horrible. Carve as that is, and Avengers is a Marvel product, but then if you combine the fact that you've got the IMAX 3D element, which I talked about earlier, for a lot of these things, and then with Jurassic World, of course, it's dinosaurs. You never underestimate the appeal of dinosaurs. And
it's such a massive pull. It's, you know, it's young, old, because at first we were thinking, oh, the only people that are going to come see it are the people that were, you know, between the ages of kind of 10 and 18, the first time it came, you know, the first film. So these people are probably going to be in their 30s or 40s now, and they are coming, but so are 5-year-olds and 10-year-olds. And for the first time, I've had children walk out of Avengers and other kind of 12As that we've had out this year, but this one, not one. I've had little 3- or 4-year-olds coming out loving it and wanting to see it again, and that's kind of the mass appeal of this film. But it's also a good indication, probably do nowhere near this, but the likes of Terminator and Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, which are also continuations of, you know, quite old franchises, and obviously
I don't think they're going to do anywhere near this.
They
will, I think, globally be around your 600 million mark.
Yeah,
they're not going to get touch a billion, because they are more niche. I know they say it sounds ridiculous with them being two of the biggest franchises ever, but if you compare them to a Marvel popular, they're not the kind of things that your little kids are going to go and see.
No, but as I said, it is a good indication for those two, and most importantly, which is closest to Jurassic World, obviously Star Wars, which is a complete giant anyway. It shows that people are still coming to the cinema, people still want to see these franchises on the big screen, and that, well, hopefully they won't get too greedy. And, you know, I know Chris Pratt signed on for another two, isn't he?
Yeah, he knows where his bread butter, to be fair.
Yeah.
They're coming for event films, though. This is the point.
Yeah.
They're not really showing up for, you know, even less so than normal. They're not showing up for films that don't have a weight of either, you know, franchise or press or some kind of key element to them. You know, in the case of Fast and Furious was a growing franchise. It also has cars, girls, guns. You've got Avengers, obviously, which is the Marvel franchise, which is a behemoth in itself, and it's the superhero bubble. You've got 50 Shades of Grey, which is sex.
Yeah.
And sex always sells. And then with Jurassic Park, you've got a combination of a franchise and the most famous monsters ever.
But the thing is, I remember writing an article in 2013 about, because it was a bad year, a really bad year for cinema. Not quite in comparison to some of the dips they've had in kind of the 90s and the early 2000s, but it was a massive dip because it was seeming like the only thing people were coming to see was superhero films.
Yeah.
And all the, you know, critics and analysts were saying exactly the same, but this year has completely changed the landscape. And you say people aren't coming out to see ordinary films. You know, we just said that Theory of Everything is the third biggest opening weekend. You know, £21 million in the UK alone. So that people are coming to see ordinary films.
But
it just
had Oscar buzz behind it.
Yeah, obviously.
There's always a reason. There's always something in the slipstream. You know, Tomorrowland is proof that
nobody went
to see Tomorrowland because it had no slipstream. It was an original property. It wasn't getting a lot of critical buzz.
Yeah.
It didn't have a star who is appealing to the young. George Clooney's great, but no kids know who George Clooney is. Probably a lot of them don't now.
No.
You know, you've got no slipstream. And that's a big worry, really.
Yeah, but it's good for cinema that these franchises are, you know, I remember when these were announced thinking, oh, you know, is this going to do anything? You know, particularly at the time, Chris Pratt hadn't even come out with Guardians of the Galaxy, so you thought, you know, who's the star power there? You know, they kind of felt lucky there, and, you know, I had my doubts about whether Star Wars was going to do anything, but with the, you know, successes that we've had so far, and no doubt that Star Wars will completely blow open the record books.
It should. I'd be surprised if it doesn't.
Up next, our review of Mr. Holmes.
It was 30 years ago. Watson had left, and the tourists had come back to Baker Street to catch a glimpse of the real Sherlock Holmes.
Was that him? I have seen Sherlock Holmes with the hat and the pipe.
I prefer a cigar. I told Watson, if I ever write a story myself, it will be to correct the myriad misconceptions created by his imagination.
Did you write such a story?
I'm trying to do so now.
The story is actually set in 1947, following a long-retired Sherlock Holmes living in a Sussex village with his housekeeper and rising detective son. But then he finds himself haunted by an unresolved 50-year-old case. Holmes's memory isn't quite what it used to be, so he only remembers fragments of the case. A confrontation with an angry husband, a secret bond with his beautiful, unstable wife. And, as we've already mentioned, stars Ian McKellen in the title role. Tony.
Mr. Holmes, it's interesting because what it does is it gives you a completely new experience of Sherlock Holmes. You know, Sherlock Holmes is a built-in idea of who Sherlock Holmes is. You've got the two standard things now. You've got the Benedict Cumberbatch kind of, you know, exciting, slightly sexy kind of modern Sherlock, but then you've got the old deerstalker pipe-smoking, you know, Victorian Sherlock of old, or, you know, the Robert Downey Jr. eccentric. You have that vision of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
You know, in that he's quick-witted, he's a dandy, he's young, he's off, you know, he's genius. This completely does it with Sherlock, something entirely new and different. You know, it presents him as a man who's at the end of his life, and who the one great thing he had, which was his mind, is failing him. And it's a really interesting film about memory and the loss of memory and what it does to somebody like Sherlock Holmes. And crucially, you know, the whole promotion of this is that it's Sherlock's final case. And the wonderful point of this film is that the mystery that he has to unlock isn't actually a mystery at all, really, in terms of actual, without giving anything away. It's not a plot mystery like you would have had in The Hound of the Baskervilles or A Study in Scarlet or something like that, like a Conan Doyle story. It's a mystery about the human heart and the humanity that Sherlock struggles with and has always struggled with. And he's at the end of his life where he's starting to wonder if he should have done things differently. And it's a really interesting idea because you've never seen Sherlock like this. He's old, he's frail. He can still do it. He can still do the moments of deduction. And there are a couple of lovely moments where he does. And he can second guess what someone's going to say, or he's, you know, by and large he can't. And the interesting thing what they do with the narrative, it's based on a book called A Slight Trick of the Mind by a writer called Mitch Cullen, and it was adapted by Bill Condon, who worked with Ian McKellen on Gods and Monsters about 20 years ago, which was about James Whale, the director of Frankenstein, one of the first openly gay people in Hollywood, like in the 30s. And that was a character study as well. It was about someone at the end of his life. And this is a similar kind of thing. And those two work really well together. And what this does is it presents the story in a fragmented style of storytelling. So it involves multiple flashbacks piled on flashbacks. So it flashes back to a recent trip Holmes had to Japan where he's looking for something, which ties into what he's going through now. And it also flashes back 30 years to when he's in his 60s and he's trying to solve his case. So we're talking about Edwardian London in like the 1910s and the slightly post-war England where he's living in the Sussex coast and he's like 93, and the story doesn't make sense until the end, and it jumbles about. And why that works, normally that wouldn't work, but why that works is because that's reflecting Holmes's mind, because he can't quite put the pieces together. And it's a really interesting idea that, you know, you're talking about a man who previously was sharp, he could get it all straight away, he deduct it immediately. Now he can't. Now he's trying to write out what happened 30 years ago to unlock this mystery that he's gnawing away at him, and before he dies, effectively, and he can't do it. And wonderfully, the only thing, the key that unlocks this is a young boy. Because by this point, Watson is long dead, so he's not got his usual partner. And one of the big things about it is that Sherlock Holmes needs Watson. He needs a Watson. He needs somebody to bounce off. He can't do it all on his own. And this young boy, played by a really good young actor called Milo Parker, really promising young actor, helps bring that out of him. And it's quite touching. That's what it's really about, their relationship. And it's quite touching.
Yeah, sorry, I had to mute here. So let someone come in.
Okay. It's really quite touching, that story between them. And Ian McKellen is phenomenal. I mean, he's always, you know it's Ian McKellen. You don't want to get him. But he really is brilliant. The makeup, he's superb, because you can see a definite difference between 93-year-old Sherlock and 60-year-old Sherlock. And the way he plays the two is completely different. The Sherlock in the scene, he's 60s, he's quite sharp, you know, he has that stately gravitas. But when he's old, he's a lot slower the way he talks, you know, he's... And it's a brilliant performance. Whether he'll get nominated, I suspect he'll get a BAFTA, or he'll get nominated for a BAFTA. I don't quite think he'll get nominated for an Oscar.
It's perhaps too early, really.
Yeah.
In terms of release to be nominated for either, but the most likely to the two is probably the BAFTA.
Yeah, I can see him getting a BAFTA nod. He might not win it, but I can see him getting a nod. Don't think he'll get an Oscar nod, but it's a wonderful performance, and it's a really sweet, quite beautiful looking film. And it's what I also liked about it was that it kind of has a contrast between the old and the new, in that there's a brilliant moment where he's in Japan and he's in the smoking ruins of Hiroshima.
Yeah,
because this is just after the bomb has dropped, and you see his reaction to this, and it's the very idea that Sherlock Holmes would be in the ruins of an atomic bomb is really interesting in itself, because that's so different from the world that you associate Sherlock Holmes with.
Yeah, absolutely.
You immediately see that he's so out of place now, and that he doesn't fit, and he knows this. And it's a very slow piece. It's very melancholic. It's very reflective, but it's actually really quite moving. And it's one of those films that I really think is going to grow on me even more. And I think when I watch it again, I will really get even more out of it. Because it kind of seeps into you. And it's a really sweet-natured film with a brilliant performance.
Laura Linney's as well, isn't she? Truman Show. That's what I remember her from.
Yeah, she's weird, because she's playing a very sort of stoutly, you know, quite serious housekeeper. And you know, if you've seen Laura Linney in films before, she's sometimes been quite sexy in things, or she's been quite,
yes, yeah,
you know, she played comedy. It's a strange casting choice, but it works. She's actually she's actually pretty good, because she's like the centre point and the rock in his life.
Yeah.
And then you've got there's a cameo from John Sessions. I won't say who he's playing, but you know, John Sessions is always good.
Yes.
Roger Allen, who plays a local doctor, and Roger Allen's a great character actor. So you've got Francis de la Tour, you've got all these really good English actors popping up at various points as well. It's really good. it's a really, really good film, and it takes, once you start thinking about it afterwards, I think Mark Kermode said this in his review actually, once you start thinking about it afterwards, it actually, you start to enjoy it even more.
Yeah.
I know I'll like it even more when I watch it again.
It's definitely the one I wanted to see this week. I will hold my hands. I'm not really that interested about Jurassic World. I will see it in this week, but before it starts disappearing in a few weeks' time. But out of the ones that have been released in the last few weeks, Mr. Holmes is definitely the most intriguing.
It's a classy picture, you know. It's a classy picture. It exudes class. It won't be for everybody.
No,
it's very slow. It the jumbled nature of the narrative will definitely put some people off, without question. Right, it takes its time. But it really does ooze class, you know. And McKellen is fabulous, and it's got plenty of layers to it.
Does it lack a Watson star? Because obviously it's the chap that plays Lewis, isn't it, in the TV series that ends up playing him? Does it kind of lack his a big star presence for that role, or is it such a minor part because obviously he's long dead?
No, again, without giving too much away, there is Watson is in there, but it's very, very, very brief.
Yeah.
And you don't need someone for it.
If anything,
it really isn't about Watson at all. This story, he's the shadow of him is there.
Yeah.
It's about Sherlock, and it would have. Having Watson involved just would have taken the point away from the whole thing, really.
Mm-hmm.
Because Sherlock is isolated, and that's the point. He's alone, and he's quite lonely, really. And that's a very, very, that's a very crucial part of the film. The other thing as well, actually, which I almost forgot to mention, is the fact that it's very meta in places, and I think you'd like it for this reason, Latham. It plays with the idea that Sherlock is a fictional character within his own world.
Right.
So there are, like, Watson wrote all the memoirs that formed the basis of the books, Conan Doyle writing. But they really lived in the flat opposite 221 Baker Street to get the tourists away from where they really worked.
Yes.
He looks out the window when he, like, the 1910s, and he sees all the tourists outside taking pictures. There's like he goes to a movie in like 1947 when he's old, which is one of the old, you know, kind of Basil Rathbone kind of Sherlock Holmes. And funnily enough, the young Sherlock Holmes being played in the movie is being played by a guy called Nicholas Rowe, who played young Sherlock Holmes in the TV series in like the 80s. So there's a lot of meta stuff going on.
Yes.
And he's sitting there watching the filmed version of this case that he could never unlock, because Watson wrote a fictionalised version with an ending that was not true. And he's sitting there watching this film, and he's just shaking his head as if to say, this isn't how it works. And then he comes out and he goes, it's rubbish.
I think I saw that in the trailer, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah, and it's really good because there's a lot of that little playing with the meta side and the film within a film and the character within a character. And there's an element of what is reality and what is fiction to this as well. That's a very interesting side of it, and I like that a lot as well. See, it plays with the myth of Sherlock Holmes.
See, I've absolutely no, apart from it being at Sherlock Holmes, I have absolutely no idea before I came here about what was he about at all. No idea. It's like a blank slate. I didn't even know there was a film called Mr. Holmes until. I'm actually quite interested in watching it now.
Yeah,
I think you'd like the meta side of things. You very much like metatextual, you know, ideas, and it has a lot. It does have like underlining as well. But it's a very different Sherlock story. I said in my written review, if you ever embarked on a journey through all the TV and movie versions of Sherlock Holmes, if you chose this to be the last one you ever watched, it's quite fitting. Because it really does serve as a very much a nice little epilogue to Sherlock Holmes. Doesn't matter what version you watch, you know, this is a nice way to wrap up Sherlock's story, really.
Interesting.
It's a nice film.
Well, Mr. Holmes and Entourage are both out in cinemas in the UK now, and will be around for probably another couple of weeks, as well as this week's other release, which is The Longest Ride, starring Britt Robertson from Merrowland, who we mentioned earlier. That one's a drama romance, if that's your kind of thing. I'm sure a review of those will be floating around the internet if you fancy checking that out. And before we finish up the show, we'll be moving on to our new feature, mine this week, as I mentioned earlier. So mine will be No Way as analytical as Emma's or as in-depth as Tony's. In fact, mine's more of a fun kind of feature, really. And we're kind of going to do like a Hall of Fame type thing where we'll go through actors and actresses, directors and films across my hosted shows and put together a Hall of Fames of people and films that haven't won an Academy Award and haven't got quite the award recognition that perhaps they deserve. We've all picked our actors for this week who we want to go in. We've got one each that will go straight into the Hall of Fame, and then we'll also have three others which we'll suggest to you, and you can vote over the course of the next few weeks of who will go in, ultimately the fourth person into the Hall of Fame. I know that Leslie Byron Pitt's going to be sitting there going, I fucking hate the Oscars, why do they care so much about award recognition? but to me, kind of, I don't know if you agree, Matt, but kind of the Oscars is kind of the crowning glory, particularly of actors. It's kind of the kind of crowning glory of their career.
It probably makes a really good ornament to put on your fireplace as well.
Yeah, or murder weapon, because it's probably quite heavy.
You said that, not me.
No, well, I'm never going to win one, so. And you can't even buy them nowadays. It's been outlawed by the Academy. You've got to return them if you don't want them. As I said, we've all got one that's going to go straight into the Hall of Fame. I've set a kind of a few regulations for it. They have to have either been nominated themselves or starred in a nominated picture to qualify. So you can't just bang out, you know, like, I'm trying to think of an example, Piers Morgan as kind of an option. Because I knew having you on the show, Nathan, we'd have to try and set some ground rules so we get some serious contenders. You've actually picked some very, very good options, apart from one of the yours.
Because my first few choices probably wouldn't have gone past your stupid rule system.
Absolutely.
What's wrong with Tommy Wiseau?
No. So my first choice is probably no surprise to anybody that knows me. He's the actor probably I love more than anybody. A bit of a man crush. Leonardo DiCaprio, nominated 4 times as an actor, as well as being part of the team who did The Wolf of Wall Street, so technically gets a nomination for the best motion picture there as well. But actually, the film that I probably think he should have won for, wasn't nominated, or at least he wasn't nominated for it, which was The Departed, which I personally believe is one of Scorsese's best films.
I've never seen it.
That film, for me, is one of his best, and it shows how dynamic he is as an actor. And actually, that kind of era of films that he was making, sounds silly, because it wasn't that long ago, but stuff like that and Blood Diamond as well were all really, really strong films, really strong contenders. Blood Diamond, for example, was one he was nominated for, actor in a leading role, where he did a very convincing South African accent, definitely better than either of us could do. We won't try, because we might offend somebody. Who are you putting straight into the Hall of Fame, Tony?
I'm going to put in Bradley Cooper.
Why?
Because a big reason was he was in Silver Linings Playbook.
Which is brilliant.
Which is a great film. I saw that recently, actually. He was, and obviously he cleaned up at the Oscars.
Mm.
It won like a ton of awards. And
Jane Ogle, didn't she?
It was nominated for a lot of awards.
Mm.
And then just Jennifer Lawrence won, if I remember rightly, actually. I'm sure that was the case. I'm sure Jennifer Lawrence won.
I think the film won a Golden Globe for, like, best drama or comedy, whatever that, comedy or musical. I think it won that. But J-Law was the only one that won.
That's it, right? So, yeah, she won for, which is fair enough, because she was fantastic in that. But he was equally as good in that role. I mean, I've always liked Bradley Cooper. I always thought he was good. I've always thought he was a pretty great actor. Right back from the days when he was in Alias.
Alias, yeah. You know, wasn't that enough?
Yeah, and they got rid of him, ironically, because they didn't think his character was up to snuff, Will Tipping in that. Or did they realise he was going to be the biggest thing in Alias by far?
They could have done an Alias movie and he'd have been the main star.
He would have been, I think. Him and Jennifer Garner just auditions together.
Can you actually think if they actually did a movie with Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Garner that... probably wouldn't even make
billing. Oh, well, yeah, she wouldn't be top billed. Yeah. Before. No. I mean, I'm surprised they haven't actually made a film together. because they got on very well and they're still friends.
She's probably still calling him saying, Bradley, Jennifer, do you want to do a movie? No, I'm busy.
All right. Yeah.
I'm busy being a raccoon.
Just the other day, I saw Bradley Cooper in and the West End in The Elephant Man.
Ah, yeah, that looked good.
He's brilliant. He gives this really, really strong physical performance, you know, as John Merrick. And it's the kind of performance that would be difficult for anybody to do, but he owns it really well. I recommend that. It's on at the Haymarket Theatre until the start of August. If you're in London, it's really good. But so you know, he's a good actor. So I think he was a bit robbed for Silver Linings Playbook, and I think there'll be more opportunities for him later on. I think he may well win one day. Obviously, he was very good in American Sniper, even though that film had its issues.
Yes. Not the sequel to Silver Linings Playbook, but where they reunited that's the one, and Amy Adams and Christian Bale, the four of them, the foursome, doing American Hustle, and he was unlucky not to get anything for that as well.
I've got my issues with that film anyway. I don't think it's Oscar worthy, really. But yeah,
certainly not as good as Silver Linings.
No, not remotely. But it got more traction, I think, to an extent behind it because of the people involved. But it was like, yeah, I think he's a good actor, and I think he deserves a nod potentially.
And Latham, who are you putting straight in?
I'm going for someone who I surprisingly only learned was only nominated for an Academy Award once, and that's Samuel L. Jackson.
Which one was he nominated for?
Best Supporting Actor for Pulp Fiction.
Ah, it's got to be that one, hasn't it?
Yeah, and he's been nominated for nothing else.
Who did he lose to? Do we know?
Dave.
That's Latham's answer for I don't know.
Best Supporting Actor.
The thing is, it's probably not going to happen either now. All the ones we've nominated so far, and I think all the ones that we're also going to put up for a vote, will potentially have an opportunity to win something. But obviously, is he like 60 or 70 now?
He's about 65, I think.
Definitely in his 60s. And he's kind of not done anything particularly serious in a long time.
He could, depending on the size of his role, he could get one for The Hateful Eight.
Yeah.
He's playing quite a big part in that, I think.
Yeah.
And that, you know, Tarantino's films, they might divide people critically, but they quite often pick up Oscar nominations. That's obviously
proved
with Pulp Fiction. So, that would be interesting.
And obviously, he's kind of coming to the end of his Fury days now. So I suppose potentially he could make a conscious career decision to start saying no to stuff, because infamously we know he says yes to practically everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes they work, like Kingsman, and sometimes they don't.
I bet you've Jennifer Garner phone Samuel L. Jackson. Hey Sam, it's Jennifer Garner. Want to do a movie? He'll probably say yes.
Yeah, he would. He would say yes. He would be in the Alias film.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Any other reason why you're putting Samuel Jackson in, other than the fact that he's Samuel Jackson?
Just to be another reason?
That means he doesn't have one.
No, I guess not.
He's one of my favourite actors. He can do low-key.
Yeah.
He can do
low-key.
Low-key performances.
I know.
I would like to see him do low-key.
That sounds wrong.
Have we just morphed into Fran Friction?
I think we're going to slash. Yeah. Some particularly nasty slash.
He's the best thing in Pulp Fiction. He's probably the best thing in a lot of stuff he's been in. I remember watching him in The 51st Date with Robert Carlyle.
Yeah.
He was brilliant in that. I think I've watched Coach Carter. I can't remember. But I do remember.
If he starts making some smart decisions and stops making stuff like The Other Guys, which also features somebody else that's going to be nominated at the moment.
I like The Other Guys.
Yeah, but that's never going to win an Oscar, is it?
It's really not.
Then, you know, he has the potential to equally pick up something. But I think out of the six that I know we're going to be potentially putting in, he's probably the least likely to pick anything up now. The next three that we're all going to nominate will go up to a vote. So until I'm next on the show, you'll have the chance to let us know on Facebook or on Twitter who you think we should be putting in out of the three that we are going to nominate now. We'll go in reverse order. So, Latham, who would you like to nominate?
My next nomination is another one who I'm quite surprised hasn't as well. This is Johnny Depp.
Mm. I'm surprised he hasn't, but I'm glad he hasn't.
Why'd you say that?
I hate Johnny Depp. It's Tim Burton that I hate more than anybody. But because he seems to be Tim's buddy's bed partner, it just puts me off Johnny Depp.
Well, he's one of these people, I think, again, he can do very similar to Samuel Jackson in that he's got a very wide range. But Johnny Depp's not afraid to expand or be a character.
No.
I mean, he's played quite a few characters and he's not afraid to go the extra mile and try and be eccentric. He also can't say no.
Tim Burton, you can't say no, no.
Yeah.
But then he ends up in shit like Dark Shadows and
Into the Woods.
Into the Woods, Mordecai.
Mordecai, God.
Mordecai, yeah.
So this is why I'm surprised you've nominated, because we've spoken about Johnny Depp quite a few times on the show, and he doesn't ever come up smelling like roses very often.
However, it's true, but I will backlight them here, because Johnny Depp does do the odd film where you realise he's a good actor.
Yeah.
Donnie Brasco.
Yeah.
Great film.
I still like Edward Scissorhands. Probably the only Tim Burton film I do like.
Edward Scissorhands, great film. Ed Wood, which is a great film with Tim Burton. Very, very good film, and he's great in Ed Wood. He does the odd film where he punches above his weight, and unfortunately he's got suckered into this Disney machine of franchise Tim Burton shit, where he's just playing comedy. And unfortunately, nobody's told Johnny Depp that he's not funny. This is the problem.
But he's got a long time coming though. Like in recent years, he's also made Transcendence, and as you said, Mordecai, and The Rum Diary, which could have been good, but was just dull. And actually, one of the most recent ones he's done, Rango, if that kind of counts, animated film back in 2011. That was a good film. But arguably, in terms of live action, he seems to be, as you said, sucking into making crap like Pirates of the Caribbean. No offence, Pirates of the Caribbean fans.
I like
don't offend them.
I like the first one.
The first one's alright.
Then they keep making more. A bit like Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah. Again, you know,
could have been okay, but you know.
Well, there'll be an Alice in Wonderland 2, I think. If not,
well, there is. Alice through the Looking Glass. Next year.
However, there is Black Mass later this
Black
year.
Black Mass. Yeah, we talked about that one, didn't we?
Now, Black Mass has potential to be Johnny Depp's next Donnie Brasco-ish kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, let's not write him off yet, because if he gets something like that, he could. Because I think after Mordecai, I think he's going to. And Alice in Wonderland, I suspect somebody might start saying to him, Johnny, you've got to pack this in now.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, he could end up going like Liam Neeson, really, to start playing hard action characters.
That would be really strange.
Potentially, like Samuel Jackson, he could be coming to his end to his Disney contract now. He's got, as I said, Alice and Pirates of the Caribbean both out in the next 2 years, and he's got quite a fair few behind him now. Into the Woods, Lone Ranger, Pirates of the Caribbean, Stranger Tides, Alice in Wonderland, so that's like four released in the last 5 years. So hopefully he's exceeded his contract and somebody will tell him not to sign a new one. Yeah. As much money as they offer him, say no.
I've always had a soft spot for the astronaut's wife. She was quite creepy in that.
Mm. In fact, all our choices really probably will divide opinion in some way. Tony's, yours is?
Mine's Mark Wahlberg.
Don't be better.
Marky.
Again, made some awful films.
Marky Mark. He has made some awful films, but he's also made films like Three Kings, which was a great film, a very, very good film. He's made The Departed, where he was fantastic in The Departed. He was
alongside my straight nomination, Leonardo DiCaprio.
There you go, alongside Leo. Terrific film. Should have been nominated for that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then Boogie Nights.
Boogie Nights. Yes.
Boogie Nights is one of the best films of the 90s, you know, by far. And
not bad in The Fighter, either.
Yeah, the fighter. Terrific in the fighter. So, you know, he'll turn around and then he'll make a shooter, or he'll make...
Pain and Gain.
Yeah, or, you know...
Broken City.
Broken City, the Four Brothers, the Italian Job. He does enough shit, don't get me wrong. But then he'll turn around, or The Happening. Oh, The Happening. Have you ever seen The Happening, Nathan? Oh, please watch The Happening. Please.
Yeah. And review that as our next classic.
Oh, yeah, it's classic. Honestly, The Happening.
Oh, and we've missed one. Transformers, Age of Extinction.
Well, yeah, and the next one, by the sound of it, because I think he's coming back for the next one.
Oh,
Max Payne as well. Yes, he's done a lot of crap. But he's always good, I always find. It's very rare that he's in a bad film and he's not just slightly better than the material. It's why I think... I dare say one day I will, unfortunately, watch Transformers 4.
Mm. Well, it's like Broken City. It's both him and Russell Crowe are let down by what is just a bad film.
Yeah.
Then, you know, neither of them come off particularly badly in it. It's just a bad film.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. When you pair him up with a Paul Thomas Anderson or a David O. Russell, you know, or a Martin Scorsese. I mean, you know, you're talking.
I think he'd be good with Tarantino.
Yeah. You put him with a Tarantino. You put him with a Christopher Nolan. You put him with these greats. He will give a good performance.
Mm.
You put him with an M. Night Shyamalan. you're gonna get what you're
gonna get,
aren't you? You know?
Yeah.
This is the point. Yeah, so if you look at his career, the films that have been shit that he's not done well in are films that are shit directors, and it, you know. And he makes some bad choices, yeah, but they all do. Johnny Depp does. Sam Jackson does. It's a common theme, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's good enough. He's good enough to get an Oscar.
The final nomination, which is my nomination, is also part of the Disney machine slash Marvel. Robert Downey Jr., most recently famous for, obviously, being Iron Man. But despite that, hasn't made that many bad films. Granted, obviously, went through a very, very quiet period kind of the early kind of 2000s, where he was going through his drug issues, but
he
obviously
Gothica.
Yeah, back. There'll always be one or two, but you know, I'll defend him in the fact that out of the three that's been nominated, he's probably made less crap films. But then he did also make Chef, but that was a fake.
I like Chef. In fact, I watched Chef last night.
Netflix.
Chef was great.
There we go, because he didn't make a bad film. Hasn't made a bad film in ages.
He's hardly in Chef. He's only in like one.
And he oddly was nominated for Tropic Thunder. That was one of the films he was nominated for. Which I kind of have a soft spot for. Brilliantly awful.
I did like Tropic Thunder, but I don't know how he got away with it.
Also nominated back in 1992 for Chaplin. Which I think is a decent film. And despite having to rival Benedict Cumberbatch, actually is not a bad Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
And the third one is apparently due within the next few years. Whether it will happen or not, we'll wait and see. Yeah, but you know, he made quite a lot in the 80s and you know, kind of early to late 90s. It was obviously, as I said, when he was kind of going through his issues that everything kind of disappeared a little bit, and he started starring in stuff like Gothica. But there was also Kiss Kiss Bang Bang 2000.
That's a brilliant film.
Brilliant film, 2005.
Great movie.
But obviously, you know, real resurgence was in 2008 when he came back as Iron Man, and he's not done all that much since. As I say, he did Tropic Thunder. He does
Zodiac. He was very good in Zodiac.
One of the best films of the last
20 years.
The Soloist, Sherlock Holmes. Due Date, which we won't talk about. And Chef, and then most recently last year, which his co-star got nominated for, was The Judge. Not the most exciting film in the world, but again, he gives a solid performance. However, unlike the other nominations, he's not got a lot coming up. He's got Sherlock Holmes 3, as I said, which has been rumoured, and obviously Captain America Civil War. So unless he's keeping things close to his chest, he's not got that much coming out in the next couple of years.
Really? He's now on a par with Tom Cruise in terms of the fact that you could put his name above a film and that would
absolutely yeah.
So and Tom Cruise only does one film a year now, pretty much.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have to do anymore, you know. And he, you know, even though Mission Impossible is huge, it's huge because of Tom Cruise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can say the same in many ways about a lot of Marvel. Marvel has partly done so well. It's a two-way process. I think Marvel gave him that career boost, but he's given Marvel equally, I think, a boost themselves.
Yeah.
So he's kind of become the kind of guy now that he doesn't really have to do much. He only has to walk into a room and everyone loves him.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's bizarre, really. But he is, despite all his troubles and everything, and he is a great actor.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
So that's your three nominations you can vote on. As I said, Facebook or Twitter. Our Twitter is at Black Hole Cinema, and it's the same for the Facebook, without the at, obviously. So you've got Robert Downey Jr., Mark Wahlberg, or Johnny Depp, who will join Samuel Jackson, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Bradley Cooper, who are currently in our Hall of Fame. Once we've filled up the Hall of Fame of people that should have won Oscars, we'll probably do the reverse and do people that shouldn't have won Oscars. Shit!
That'll be fun.
And I know there's some fans of him out there. Bloody Nicolas Cage. I have a whole IMDb list of people that should have won Oscars over Nicolas Cage.
That knocking you can hear is probably Chris Wilson with an axe.
Nicolas Cage. There's actually someone I work with. I recently hired a few months ago who fucking loves Nicolas Cage, and every film I go, he made this. He goes, but he made this, and I'm like, yeah, but it's shite. He's like, oh, I love it. I was like, you're an idiot, and I shouldn't have hired you.
I would say there is a whole one of the big things in Mr. Holmes is that he's a beekeeper. Sherlock Holmes, and obviously there's a lot of stuff involving where he's at his apiary and all this, and genuinely there were more than one time in that while I was watching that film where in my head I'm going, not the bees!
So that's your three nominations to choose from. You can vote on Twitter or Facebook, and that brings us to the end of the show as well. I did warn you it wouldn't be quite as analytical and as in-depth as Tony's and Emma's. Just a bit of fun, really, because I was scraping the barrel of what I would do. So
that's fine. Me and Emma, you know, we don't provide fun, so someone's got
to
do it.
Yeah. So if you ever want to listen to a fun one, then just ignore everybody else. Just come listen to mine. No, don't do that. Do go back and listen to the last 2 weeks, if not for the reviews, but for the features. They're both fantastic. And we'll be back next week for more reviews. Emma Platt will be hosting, and the main review, obviously, will be Minions, which no doubt will knock Jurassic World off the top spot. But nothing is a given when it's Jurassic World. It could bloody go on for months, and it was definitely be in the top 10, that's for sure. I wouldn't be surprised if come September it's still showing in cinemas.
The way it's going.
September 2016.
Absolutely. But till the next one comes out. Yes. You can find me on Twitter at Dan Thomas Taylor. Tony on Twitter
At Black Hole Writer, and obviously the Black Hole Cinema one is Black Hole Cinema.
And Matt Latham is at
The Bottle App.
And at Zandermatt. Are you ever going to start Bottle App, Matt?
It might be very, 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 very soon, or sooner than you may think. Keep an eye on that Twitter feed in the next couple of days.
Hashtag cryptic.
Exciting.
Hashtag very, very soon.
But thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week. And until then, we'll keep watching the films that you don't have to.